time for It's All About Food. And I am Karen Hartglass, the founder of the nonprofit Responsible Eating and Living. And I wanted to tell you that October is the time for our real appeal at Responsible Eating and Living. We're a 501c3 not-for-profit organization. If you know about us, you've been to our website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. You can find out lots of information about real eating and living, responsible eating and living. And visit our donate button there. You can read our real appeal, find out what we're up to, and if you are so moved, you can support us because we only do what we do with help from people like you. Okay, that's the real appeal, responsibleeatingandliving.com. And let's move on. I want to talk to my first guest, Melanie Joy. She's the founder and president of Carnism Awareness and Action Network. Dr. Joy is a Harvard-educated psychologist, professor of psychology and sociology at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, celebrated speaker, and the author of the award-winning primer on carnism, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. She has written a number of articles on psychology, animal protection, and social justice, and she has been featured on programs including the BBC, National Public Radio, PBS, ABC Australia, and Good Morning Croatia, and in Slovenia's Jana, the Austrian Der Standard, and the Italian Le Scienze. Dr. Joy has given her critically acclaimed carnism presentation across the United States as well as internationally. She's also the author of Strategic Action for Animals. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so this is going to be a fun half hour talking about carnism.
Well, I always enjoy talking about carnism, and I suppose I should explain just what carnism is.
Please do.
Before we start talking about it. The way I like to explain what carnism is by using an example. If you could just imagine that you are a guest at a dinner table, at a dinner party, and your host has just served you a delicious beef stew. And in fact, you find the stew so delicious that you ask the host for her recipe. And she replies that the secret is in the meat. You need to start out with 3 pounds of extra lean golden retriever. Most people's, at least in this culture, response is an example of carnism. Carnism is the invisible belief system or ideology that conditions us to eat certain animals. It's essentially the opposite of veganism. And we tend to believe that it's only vegans and vegetarians who bring their beliefs to the dinner table, but most of us don't learn to eat pigs but not dogs, for example, because we don't have a belief system when it comes to eating animals. Really, when eating animals is not a necessity for survival, which is the case in much of the world today, then it's a choice, and choices always stem from beliefs.
It's interesting. I'm sure when you describe that scenario of people around the table, you have this fantastic video that people can see right on your website, carnism.com, that little trailer introducing your book and that scenario you just described, and the reaction for most people is nausea when they think about eating something that they're not used to eating. And it's fascinating to me because if you go around the world, there are people that eat dogs, there are people that eat bugs, there are people that eat all kinds of things. It doesn't make it a good, but people do it, and they're somehow trained to do so.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely right. And the response is one of disgust. And not only do we see different disgust responses, or I should say responses of disgust to different types of foods around the world, but we can also experience this ourselves. For instance, most people today who are vegan and who do find the flesh of all animals disgusting quite likely did not feel that way when they were growing up. Most people who become vegan after they've made a conscious choice to stop eating animals. And so it's really striking because in meat-eating cultures around the world, people tend to have a tiny handful of animals out of thousands of possible species that they've learned to classify as edible. All the rest we learn to classify as inedible, and often we find them disgusting and even offensive to consume. So even though the type of species consumed changes from culture to culture, all cultures tend to have this disgust response. And, you know, as you mentioned, it's what happens is we essentially learn how, or you alluded to this somehow, you know, we learn how not to be disgusted. I would suggest, and my research on the psychology of eating animals strongly suggests, as well as other people's research, that we really do have a natural empathy for animals. Most people truly do not want to cause animals to suffer, now, let alone participating in that suffering. Most people do not feel comfortable with the idea of harming animals, and yet most of us grow up learning to eat animals, often multiple times a day, and so our natural empathic response becomes blocked by this invisible belief system that essentially guides our food choices like an invisible hand, shaping the very way that we think or don't think and feel or don't feel about eating animals.
On that subject,
carnism is structured in such a way to block our awareness and shut down our empathy when it comes to those animals who we have learned to classify as edible, as food.
I don't know if it's because of carnism, because of people's acceptance of eating animals, or something bigger, but most people don't know what's in their food. You know, we occasionally have these different sensational things that come out in the media. The one most recent that comes to mind is the pink slime, where they're using this, what they call this lean beef, that where they're taking out the fat with ammonium hydroxide and putting it back into meat just to extend it so that they can make more of it for less. And people seemed really repulsed by this. And yet there are so many different products that are manufactured and made with all kinds of things that we really shouldn't be consuming. And most people accept this and don't think about it.
Yeah, well, it's really what's really interesting is that ideologies such as carnism, you know, carnism is arguably a system of oppression. It's truly organized around violence. You know, meat cannot be procured without killing. We're talking about 10 billion animals per year, land animals alone. In the United States alone, are slaughtered in a way that would make, you know, even the most stoic of us cringe were we to witness this. For their flesh and other body parts. And so ideologies such as carnism that rely on violence, that are organized around violence and oppressing one group, you know, for the benefit of another, need to use a set of social and psychological defense mechanisms so that humane people can participate in inhumane practices without fully realizing what they're doing. And these defense mechanisms are, you know, they're institutionalized, they're woven through the very structure of society, and they also become internalized. And so you can see myriad examples of the ways in which we learn to psychologically distance ourselves from our food when it comes to eating animals and the products procured from their bodies. So we look at, you know, a packaged piece of hamburger, for instance, and we don't see somebody, we see something. We are just distanced. We use the language that we use to describe our food. You know, we don't call it cow flesh, we call it beef. So there are a host of different ways that we disconnect, and sometimes what happens is that these defenses are pierced by something. Something makes it onto the news, you know, some sort of an abuse that becomes recognized in a CAFO or a factory farm, and it makes the 11 o'clock news, and then people start to feel uncomfortable about what they're eating. Pink slime is another example. Something pierces that veil of denial or disconnect, or, you know, one of the defenses that we've learned to erect.
And then a handful of people get it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I can say that I personally grew up eating animals for much of my life, like most of us. And I know that for me personally, I was exposed. Most people who become vegan at some point in time, you know, have been exposed to information. The information is out there. It's all around us. And often we need to be exposed multiple times in a variety of ways before we actually are ready to make that connection.
Yeah, absolutely.
And most people, like I said, really do care about animals. Most people are fundamentally humanitarian in their values.
Yeah,
and,
that's so true.
People do not make that connection, or as you would say, get it. You know, connection between the flesh on their plate and the living being it once was, that connection between, you know, slaughtering somebody, taking the life of somebody, a life, you know, taking somebody's life, a life that mattered to them, simply because we like the way their thighs taste. Most of us don't make that connection until we're in a position in our lives, psychologically and socially and practically, in order to make the changes that will inevitably follow. And we need to be, you know, in a position where we really feel secure enough to do that.
There's a lot of reactions that people make. Something I don't like to do is read comments on articles that are online. New York Times puts up an article or some other prominent newspaper, and there's a lot of conversation about veganism, vegan diets, celebrities that are vegans, whether it's better to be one or the other. And then you read the comments, and there are some that are so, they're so angry. And vegans can be called close-minded. Vegans can be called fanatics. All different kinds of things. And I actually think the people that are using these words are what they are calling other people.
Well, I mean, one way that you, you know, that oppressive systems, that dominant institutionalized ideologies, such as carnism, maintain themselves is by pathologizing those who challenge the oppressive status quo. I mean, there's a lot of projection involved. I mean, there's, I've met people, you know, who are staunchly committed to, I mean, they're meat loyalists to a degree that I, you know, it's quite surprising in some ways, and quite resistant to taking in some of this information. And, you know, and as you point out, often this experience is turned around and projected onto vegans. And but this is the way that, and this is not true for everybody. I mean, many people, are, especially today, are becoming very open to this issue and really do want to learn about the impact of their choices on themselves and their world. But, you know, one of the ways that we shut down critical dialogue that challenges an oppressive status quo is by pathologizing those who challenge it, you know. So, you know, people, Malcolm X is a good example. You know, he's called biased and extremist when he challenged the biases and extreme practices of the dominant racist culture. We see similar phenomena happening with vegans today. It's, you know, if we shoot the messenger, we don't have to take seriously the implications of his or her message.
I'm one of the believers that racism, homophobism, sexism, speciesism, all of these forms of exploitation are really the same thing. I'm a big picture kind of person.
Yep.
And but many people tend to want to focus on one small piece. For some reason, they can't move entirely over. So, you know, some people will be gay rights proponents, or they'll be working towards people of color supporting minority rights or something, and they seem somewhat offended when you want to give animals rights.
Yeah, well, there are various reasons for that. I mean, I think there's a difference between where you focus your energy and your work and what kind of a consciousness you uphold while you're doing that work. I mean, we only have so much time and energy, and we can't be working equally hard for every single cause out there, obviously.
Oh, but do I need to learn that one? Yeah.
Right. But we can bring with us a consciousness of liberation, and a consciousness of liberation is the opposite of a consciousness of oppression. It's, you know, when we're you know, striving to transform any form of oppression, it's so important to keep in mind what Martin Luther King said, which is that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. What that means is that it's vital that, and this is part of our mission at CAN, Carnism Awareness and Action Network, it's vital that we look at the ways in which all oppressions are interconnected and reinforcing. Otherwise, we'll simply trade one form of oppression for another. And it's important also, I think, to recognize that, you know, when we compare oppressions, there can be a lot of defensiveness around this, as you've pointed out. People don't want to be compared to animals, for instance. You know, just as, you know, proponents, you know, some proponents of feminism a number of years ago didn't want to be compared to people of color. And, you know, this just reflects the various ways in which we all can compartmentalize. And, you know, we're constantly working to have a broader analysis, or in my opinion, we should be constantly working to have a broader analysis, and we all have blind spots. When we're born into carnism, a system that is so deeply entrenched, this you know, sub-ideology of speciesism, where we learn to value the human species morally and place ourselves so far above those of other members of all other species, then we find it offensive to be compared to somebody who is not human, which is simply a reflection of our own internalized oppression that we, you know, this own, internalized oppressive view of the world that we've inherited. But when we're talking about the, you know, interlocking oppressions, one way to get around this understandable defensiveness, because many people have it for many different reasons in many different areas, it's important to point out that, you know, the experience of each set of victims will always be somewhat unique. We're not saying that anybody's suffering is identical to anybody else's suffering. But what is vital for us to recognize is that the ideologies or the systems themselves are structurally similar. And that's because the mentality that enables these ideologies is the same. The mentality of domination and subjugation, the mentality of privilege and oppression, it's a might makes right mentality. Ultimately, I believe that if we seek to cultivate a truly just and humane world, then it's essential that we incorporate all oppressive isms into our analysis, including carnism, because eating animals is not simply a matter of personal ethics. It is the inevitable end result of a deeply entrenched oppressivism. Eating animals is really a social justice issue.
You came out with your book a couple of years ago. I can't believe it's been that long already. and a lot's happened since then. So the response was really pretty tremendous, wasn't it?
It has been, and I'm on the second year of a speaking tour now, a national speaking tour that was sponsored by Farm Sanctuary, the nation's leading farmed animal protection organization that's now really expanded into an international speaking tour where I travel around giving my presentation on carnism to mixed groups, largely non-vegan audiences. And the response has been just overwhelmingly positive everywhere I've been, you know, including in fairly rural Croatia. And I find this to be testament to the fact that, you know, there's the time is right to have this kind of conversation, but people really do care. I almost never meet a person who doesn't cringe when faced with images of animal suffering, and I almost never meet a person who doesn't truly want to live a life that reflects their core values, their authentic thoughts, not the kind of thoughts and values and feelings that they've been conditioned to have. Most people want to make choices that are in their own best interest and in the interest of others, and carnism socializes us to act against our own interests and the interests of others. So it's tremendously empowering for people to really recognize the truth, not simply about animal agriculture, but about carnism, the system that has conditioned and shaped our preferences and thoughts and feelings since we were old enough to be weaned.
Have you spoke to enough to have formed just an impression? Is it any different outside of the United States, the reaction to this concept? You know, I know like in Europe, for example, they seem to be a little bit more progressive when it comes to their food system. You know, there's plenty of flaws, but they're more against genetically modified food and trying to keep things local. And there are some things that they're making more of an effort to protect.
Well, I mean, I do speak to a lot of progressive audiences in the United States, too. So I think it's a little bit difficult to compare entire countries because within these countries, the groups that I'm speaking to are largely more progressive-minded groups anyway. One of the things that I find that, you know, I've really been working to address a bit more fully is what many progressives or self-identified progressives would consider a sustainable way of eating or, you know, eating so-called humane animal products. And that's something that is discussed in Europe, but it's also discussed in the United States quite a bit. In general, the reaction is quite similar everywhere that I've spoken so far. But I think it's very important to point out when we're talking, most people do start, you know, considering eating animal products that come from what we call sustainable farms or, you know, quote-unquote humane production, you know, or humane, I don't want to say factory farms, but that are humanely produced. And I think it's really important to really have this conversation within the context of carnism, because once we step outside of the system, we can analyze and examine these practices, I think, a bit more objectively. And, you know, so for instance, most people in the United States anyway, and in much of the world, most people would not condone killing a perfectly healthy 6-month-old golden retriever simply because, you know, her legs taste good.
Right.
And yet most people who support so-called humane meat or sustainable meat do, in fact, participate in exactly the same practice.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, it happens to be directed towards somebody of a different species.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important, you know, to acknowledge that carnism influences and conditions the way that we view and relate to other beings and the consumption of their bodies in very deep ways. And even though we may change the way that we understand our food or change the way that some animals were raised, it doesn't change the fact that somebody is being created for the sole purpose of being killed, for the sole purpose of pleasing the palate of someone who doesn't actually need to be eating their body.
Have you come up with variations of the word in different languages?
Well, there is, there are, people are writing and presenting on carnism in Europe right now,
mm-hmm.
which is wonderful, and so I don't remember how to pronounce it in Slovenian. The book is in Croatian and it's in Slovenian. I don't remember how to pronounce it there. It's carnismus with a K in Germany, carnisma with a E in France,
mm-hmm.
And in French, but yes, there are a number of different ways of writing and pronouncing it.
Well, I definitely support adding words to our vocabulary. We know that we evolve so much more when we have more words to explain more things. And, you know, we've seen this in times when dictators or people that try to control a community, one of the things that they might do is take away their books, take away some of their language, because that helps to... what's the word I'm looking for? It's not a good thing. And so it's good to have more language to describe certain things. Carnism's a good one, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's a great Scrabble word, except it's probably not accepted yet on the online versions.
I hadn't thought about that when I coined the word, but that is a point. I'd like to see it as a Scrabble word one day. And you're absolutely right. I mean, our words shape our reality, our perception of reality. By not naming carnism, we don't see it. And when we don't see it, we can't question it, we can't challenge it. We grow up believing that eating animals is a given rather than a choice.
Yeah. Now let's talk about what you're doing with your carnism awareness and action network. You're developing task forces. You have some ambitious plans. What's going on?
Well, our goal, really, our mission is to raise awareness of and challenge carnism, and CAN acts as a hub of international carnism awareness activity. And so we have a few things that we're focusing on right now that we're very excited about. We are the first organization, the only organization, to my knowledge, to focus on direct institutional change, not only individual outreach. Our infrastructure is constructed to systematically and strategically target institutionalized oppression, institutionalized carnism, which is challenging the institutions that validate animal agriculture. Animal agriculture is one institution, but that institution would not exist if not for all of the other social institutions that enabled it. And so to this end, we've been developing carnism awareness task forces, which are groups of professionals, and those going into the professions, working together to raise awareness of and challenge carnism within their fields. And in such a way, we're working to transform the system from within and not simply from the outside.
So what are some of the examples, like universities? Because there are a lot of universities that do research to support animal agriculture.
Well, yes. Well, we have, educators would be an example. University students would be an example of working within education. We have our mental health professionals task force, which, for instance, you know, challenge carnistic bias in the institution, in the profession. So, for example, it's still not terribly uncommon today for a young woman's choice to become vegan to be considered symptomatic of potential eating disorder. So to challenge carnistic bias in research, to develop new research, you know, looking at post-traumatic stress as people experience this. For instance, we've had a number of people contact us and myself over the years who have been, either raised around animals being killed, activists who are seriously traumatized from witnessing the violence of carnism and animal agriculture. So our task forces are working on examining the impact of this particular type of carnism-induced trauma on people and writing about that. So really raising awareness, giving presentations, cultivating new research and challenging current research within the institutions is what our task forces are going to be doing.
Yeah, there are just so many things that are connected not just to eating animals but to exploitation animals. It's that block. You know, I was just reading a book. A friend of mine wrote a book about a dog she used to have and how important that little dog was to her life and how much she learned. But throughout the book, she talks about how she mistreated the dog, and in hindsight, she realizes this. But people that even love their animals will do things to them and not realize that they're cruel.
Right, and people who love people will do things to them and not realize
exactly.
That they're cruel.
Why do we do those things? You're the psychologist.
Why do we do these things? We can. It's a lot of this is about really, our relationship with other animals is not terribly different from our relationship with other humans, in that it reflects our current state of mind, our current state of consciousness, our own self-awareness, our own commitment to being empathic and connected, and these qualities that we, the very qualities that we need to cultivate to be our best selves in our relationships with other humans are the same qualities that will help us to treat other animals with compassion. We can approach our lives and the world with curiosity and open minds and compassion and open hearts, the courage to practice these convictions, a commitment to practicing integrity, which is really living our values, or we can move through the world in a very different way, which is, a mindset of disconnection and self-focus, and not in a good way, self-focus, and othering those around us. And, that second way of moving through the world is really the foundation of prejudice. The same psychological mechanisms that enable us to harm other humans enable us to harm other animals. And so compassion begets compassion.
I believe that a piece of our problem, a significant piece, is what we see and hear in the media, in the mainstream media. Was there a response to your concept of carnism in the mainstream world, positive or negative?
Well, most of the interviews that I've done have been in more progressive circles.
Yeah.
In general, there's been a quite positive response. I mean, there has been some defensiveness, and I would, be lying if I didn't say that. But but overall, the response has been largely positive. And I find, and this is also just in my day-to-day life when I'm on an airplane and I'm sitting next to somebody and they're asking where I'm going. It's the same thing. Most people I find, when they hear the title of my book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, that opens up a conversation, and most people are genuinely curious.
Yeah.
Because we have that, most of us, who grew up in carnistic culture have that knowing without knowing. On one level, we're aware that somebody has to die for our plate whenever we eat animals or the products procured from their bodies. And on another level, we just don't connect the dots. And there's this cognitive moral dissonance, this disconnect, this moral discomfort that most of us carry around, and a curiosity around that. And so I find that people do, if you can have these conversations in a way that are not attacking or blaming and approach the situation with curiosity and compassion, then you can have really wonderful, rich, productive conversations.
We have just like 30 seconds left, so what shall we tell everyone? Go to carnism.com, read Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. What else?
Yeah, well, at Carnism, Awareness and Action Network, our goal is not to, simply change people. Our goal is to raise awareness. so that people can make their choices freely, because without awareness, there is no free choice. So we exist to support people who are, you know, still eating animals, and to support people who are vegan activists and advocates, to help them feel more grounded in their choices and more empowered in their lives and have more sustainable lives as individuals and as activists. So we really want to be a resource for everybody who wants to learn more and become a part of the solution to carnism.
I like it. Thank you so much, Melanie Joy, for joining me today on It's All About Food.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Okay. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is the first part of our program, so we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And we are in part two of the program today, October 16, 2012. And I am really looking forward to speaking with my next guest, Dr. William Davis, the author of Wheat Belly. He is a preventative cardiologist whose unique approach to diet allows him to advocate reversal, not just prevention of heart disease. And this book, Wheat Belly, is number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 25 weeks. I'm looking at this weekend's paper. He is the founder of TrackYourPlaque.com program and lives in Wisconsin. Welcome to It's All About Food, Dr. Davis.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Good to be here.
Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I just finished reading your book, and I found it quite interesting and entertaining.
Well, thank you.
It's always good to have a sense of humor, and I enjoyed all of that that was included in reading about wheat. The thing that I found most interesting, and I'd like to start talking about with that, is the history of wheat and how wheat has changed.
Yeah, that's a very important point, because a lot of people do not know that modern wheat is nothing like the wheat that our moms had or grandmothers had. So many people will say things, for instance, like, well, humans have been eating wheat for thousands of years. What's wrong with it now? Well, it's very different. So modern wheat is an 18-inch tall, what's called semi-dwarf strain. This is the creation of genetics research that was conducted in the 60s and 70s. It was conducted to increase the yield per acre. And it was magnificently effective. So modern wheat is anywhere from 8 to 10-fold more yield per acre than the wheat of 1960. But problems. And the genetics people in agribusiness don't tell you this.
Of course
not. If you change the appearance of something, and in this case quite dramatically, if you change the appearance of something, you change other things. You change its biochemistry. You change its genetics. You change multiple other aspects of this plant. But no questions are asked when these kinds of foods are introduced. And so we are unwittingly sold these things with virtually no testing for effects on humans. And it was unleashed on us on a widespread basis in the early 80s.
What's interesting is how manufacturers of these products actually talk out of two sides of their mouth. Like you said, on one side they say it's new and improved and it yields great and it's easy to produce. And then on the other side they say there's nothing different about it. It's the same product.
That's right.
It can't be the same and be different.
That's right.
But, you know, we swallow it, don't we? And as a result...
hook, line, and sinker.
Yes, and I used the pun intentionally, because when we swallow it, we have repercussions. Can we just back up a little bit and get some basic biology? Because I want to talk... I know a lot of people are confused about hybridization and genetically modified. And so my understanding is... in terms of semantics, the modern genetically modified technology that Monsanto and DuPont and other companies have, wheat has not been genetically modified in this sense where scientists in a lab have gone in and try to replace one gene in a chromosome with another.
Exactly right. So modern wheat was created using methods that predate genetic modification. So in the language of geneticists, no gene splicing techniques were used to insert or delete a gene, as in, say, glyphosate-resistant corn. So modern wheat was created by using, as you point out, hybridizations, what's called backcrossing, multiple backcrossings, where you cross with a different strain over and over and over again to get the characteristic you want. It was also crossed with very dissimilar grasses to introduce foreign unique proteins. But then there are a whole range of other, sometimes bizarre techniques, like rescuing defective embryos, which is commonly done, by the way, and the techniques of what are called mutagenesis, that is the purposeful induction of mutations. There are three ways to do this. You can do it with chemicals, you can do it with gamma rays, like making the Hulk, and you can do it with X-ray, high-dose X-ray.
So none of them sound good to me.
No, these are bizarre. So these are very crude techniques to induce mutations. The problem is these are very crude and unpredictable techniques. These are techniques that are much worse than genetic modification. So believe it or not, even though everyone's in an uproar over genetic modification is actually an improvement over the methods that were being used. Now, here's the problem. All the results of the crude techniques that predate genetic modification are already on store shelves and have been there for 20 to 30 years, and we've been eating them.
Now, we kind of have a, I don't know, a romance somewhat with hybridization. It's been going on for so long. Some of it nature has done. Some of it farmers have done. But still, there are genetic modifications, even when we do this accepted hybridization.
That's right. So every time you mate a mama plant and a daddy plant, you get some percentage of unique. In other words, you are somewhat like your dad, you're somewhat like your mom, but you're not a perfect duplicate of either. You have your own unique characteristics, maybe outward appearance, internal biology, etc. Same thing with plants, that the offspring are somewhat unique. And most of the time, thank goodness, hybridization, if I hybridize two strains of tomatoes, that offspring tomato is likely very safe. But when taken to extremes, as many thousands of repetitive hybridizations, and then these other techniques that are sometimes bizarre and very unnatural. Let me tell you a quick story then. Clearfield wheat is a strain of wheat that's resistant to the herbicide Beyond. The patent is held by the BASF Corporation, the world's largest chemical manufacturer. It's grown on about 1 million acres in the Pacific Northwest. So this thing is resistant to the herbicide Beyond. Well, how did they make it resistant to the herbicide Beyond? They exposed the embryo of wheat seed, of wheat plants, to a chemical called sodium azide, which is a highly toxic industrial chemical. If there's an accidental ingestion, the poison control people tell you, don't offer that victim CPR because you're going to die too. And if the victim throws up, vomits, don't throw the vomit in the sink because it's going to explode. And that has actually happened.
Wow.
So this is the stuff used to induce mutations in the wheat plant. They did that. They made it after many tries, resistant to the herbicide Beyond or Amizmox, and then they sold it. Now it's consumed by a lot of people in the U.S. and other nations, but never tested for its suitability for human consumption.
So there's a lot of strange things that are going on with our food, and some of them have been going on for a while, some a little more recent, some a little less recent, but we're seeing problems with wheat, wheat intolerance, wheat allergies, and certainly celiac disease. And you believe that it's a result of all this playing around with the wheat.
Absolutely. So, for instance, there's a protein in wheat called gliadin. And the GLI alpha 9 genetic sequence has been amplified enormously. It's virtually absent in the wheat of 1960. It's present in virtually all modern wheat. And this is the gene that codes for the thing that triggers gluten sensitivity and celiac disease. So we know that celiac disease has quadrupled over the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. We know that gluten sensitivity, that is the belly aches and irritable bowel type syndrome symptoms and even joint pains from gluten. But here's the problem. So many people say, well, I don't have a gluten problem. So celiac disease and sensitivity to gluten is probably 8, 9, or 10% of the population. I'm much more concerned about the other 90%, because that's the other 90%. The celiac experts are telling those people, oh, go ahead and eat wheat. No, 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 no. There are problems in modern wheat that go beyond the gluten. So, for instance, this new form of gliadin not only stimulates intestinal problems, it's also an opiate, and it stimulates appetite.
Mm.
So this modern form of gliadin stimulates an increase in calorie intake such that the average person takes in 440 more calories per day, 365 days per year. If you do the math, that's a ton of calories. That's a ton of weight you're going to gain just from the appetite-stimulating effects of wheat. By the way, your appetite's not stimulated for salmon and beef. It's stimulated for carbohydrates and junk food. It's stimulated for more wheat products like bagels and cookies and chips and other junk foods. And you can see, all we have to look around us and see the effect of this.
I just wonder about the wheat growers or people that use wheat in their products, if they are familiar with this. I do remember reading about artificial sweeteners like aspartame, and they also increase your appetite. And so here someone is having a diet drink and with this artificial sweetener, hoping to lose some weight, and it's actually making them hungry. So there's probably a number of different things that we're eating that trick us and make us do things we don't want to do. And wheat is a big one.
I think, this is my pure speculation now, I have no proof, that the food industry has known about this for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can think of no other reason to explain why wheat is now in virtually every processed food. It's not just in rolls and pancake mix. It's in Twizzlers, Lipton instant soup, Campbell's tomato soup, taco seasoning, frozen foods, granola, and virtually all breakfast cereals. You'll be hard-pressed to find a processed food that does not contain wheat.
But that being said, it is possible to avoid eating wheat, even though it's in so many products. And that's what you advocate. No wheat.
Absolutely. It's a return to real single-ingredient foods. So we know that green peppers don't have wheat. We know that cucumbers don't, or olive oil, or lamb chops, or salmon. So it's a return to real single-ingredient foods that we know food manufacturers have managed to muck up the least.
Well, you probably heard Jack LaLanne, who used to say, if man made it, don't eat it.
He was way ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of us in the alternative food movement that are trying to change the current food system. I want to mention Michael Pollan because he recently, in this New York Times this past weekend, the food and drink issue, he was questioning if there really was a food movement. I also remember him saying a few months ago that he was dubious about the wheat intolerance epidemic. My point is that there are lots of us who want to improve the quality of our food, and we don't agree on everything. But there are things that we can agree on, and I certainly think we can agree on people getting back to eating minimally processed whole foods as much as possible. All of these created, packaged things are high in calories, high in artificial ingredients, high in manufactured substances, hybridized substances like wheat that contain things that are not healthy for us. And going to the produce section that's where I get most of my food.
Mm-hmm. You know, there have been criticisms of the arguments I make, but you know, I find it's because people often think they understand what it is I'm saying until they actually hear the real arguments, and they realize they knew nothing about wheat or what this thing was they're being sold. You know, I've engaged in debates, on-air debates with PhD nutritionists, and what I found was it was like arguing with children because they knew nothing about what had been done to modern wheat and the peculiar components that are now present. They thought I was just talking about, for instance, a blood sugar effect, and it's not about just that. There's so many other aspects, such as this gliadin protein of wheat that stimulates appetite. That, by the way, is quite well sorted out. There are other things. It's as if, and this is not true. I don't believe this was intentional. I think it's just a series of incredible blunders. But when you look at this thing in all its components, it's as if this thing was crafted for maximal destruction.
Mm. I think we have a great movie to come out, the Wheat Monster. Now, what about wheatgrass, for example? Is that okay?
Probably not. So you raise the issue now of wheat germ agglutinin. So wheat germ agglutinin is a protective See, we have lymphocytes and antibodies and all sorts of complex mechanisms to protect us from bacteria and viruses and other invaders. Plants don't have such things. Mm. They have a much simpler protection system called lectin proteins. Lectins are usually benign, so spinach has a lectin. We can eat spinach just fine without a problem. But there are not so benign lectins like ricin. Ricin is the lectin of a castor bean, and this is highly toxic. It's a neurotoxin. In fact, it's been used in about a dozen terrorist attacks worldwide with fatal effect. Well, the lectin of wheat is wheat germ agglutinin. It's not benign like that in spinach, but it's not as destructive as the ricin from castor beans. It's somewhere in between.
Mm.
So wheat germ agglutinin, if I feed a milligram of purified wheat germ agglutinin, 1 milligram, a tiny little speck of wheat germ agglutinin to a laboratory rat, its intestinal tract is destroyed. It creates changes very similar to celiac disease. Now, humans don't eat, of course, purified wheat germ agglutinin, but the average person takes in between 10 and 20 milligrams per day of wheat germ agglutinin. And that doesn't cause immediate intestinal destruction. It causes chronic low-grade intestinal destruction. And it can be expressed as acid reflux or the bowel urgency of irritable bowel syndrome, or it might be expressed as having Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, but just much worse. Because this thing is an intestinal toxin.
What about, you mentioned a website, growseed.org, the Heritage Wheat Conservancy. I was happy to read about that.
Well, that's Elisheva Rogosa, who's a very interesting lady in Massachusetts, who came back from Israel, where she worked in the GenBank project, where they were trying to resurrect the ancient grains. And they genetically tested these grains to prove what strains they were. And one of the things she brought back was einkorn. And so you now know the einkorn she brought back is a 14 chromosome. It's the great ancestor of all wheat in the world. So modern wheat's a 42 chromosome plant. What Elie Rogosa brought back was the original descendant of 14 chromosome wheat, the original wheat that predates even biblical wheat. So she sells that seed now. Now, I'm not an advocate of returning to the older ancient strains of wheat, because I do think that when humans, as hunter-gatherer cultures, first incorporated even wild grains, there were health prices to pay. There were more dental cavities. There was more bone disease. So it's not as if the older grains are entirely benign. They are better. They're far less harmful than, say, this modern semi-dwarf 42-chromosome strain. But they're not entirely benign. So my personal view is if you want ideal health, you do not consume anything that comes from the wheat family. Though I have to admit, if the world as a whole converted to one of the more ancient strains of wheat that predate all these changes, we would be far better off.
I remember reading somewhere, I can't even remember where it was now, but when agriculture began and then we were able to grow grains, we were able to feed more people, but it wasn't necessarily more healthfully.
I think that's the compromise that's been struck. That is, there's no question that these high-yield crops, whether it's high-yield semi-dwarf wheat or high-yield genetically modified rice or soybean or potatoes, I think there's no question at least some of these crops did help solve world hunger in some parts of the world. When modern semi-dwarf wheat was introduced into Ethiopia and Bangladesh and rural China, within a year, famine was converted to surplus. In fact, there are photos of mountains of wheat seed sitting in the square of small villages where no one wanted it anymore because it was too much when there had been starvation just a year before. So I think there is an aspect of this that it did help solve world hunger. The problem is, I think we've compromised by selling a very flawed food that, while it may solve hunger in the near term, causes health problems, very significant health problems in the long term. compounds, of course, by this ridiculous idea of cutting our fat and eating more healthy whole grains, as we get through such education vehicles as the food pyramid, food plate, Health Canada's message, all that sort of thing.
Now, we know that you and I know that wheat is a problem, and you've given good reason for why it is, but we've done some similar things to a lot of other things that we grow.
That's right. So the only problem in the world is not wheat, but I think it sits at the top. It is the king of kings, the worst of the worst. So if we eliminate all genetically modified corn, let's say, or for that matter, all corn, I think we will have better health. I think we'll have lower blood sugar. We'll lose a few pounds. If we limit all sugar, we would indeed be better off. Many people would lose some weight. Their blood sugar would drop. Their blood pressure would drop. They'd feel a little better. But I know of nothing that will match the power of eliminating modern wheat, because that's where you see not just a few pounds lost, but 30, 70, 150 pounds lost. That's where you see so much of a drop in blood sugar that we have diabetics every day becoming non-diabetic, getting rid of insulin and drugs. We have blood pressures dropping so much we have to have people supplement salt and sodium. We have migraine headaches disappearing, acid reflux and the bowel urgency of irritable bowel syndrome disappearing. People with inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's having dramatic relief or cure. We have people with psychiatric illnesses like schizophrenia, bipolar illness, eating disorders, food obsessions, children with ADHD and autism having dramatic improvements, not cure in that case, but dramatic improvements in behavior, attention, and other measures of mental health. In other words, nothing can approach the health benefits of removing modern wheat.
I agree that wheat is a good thing to eliminate from the diet. There are other foods that people are talking about more and more that are problematic. Is there any plan to have some sort of clinical study to match your dietary plan with other diets?
Well, that's the incredible thing. These data already exist. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if I made this up some Tuesday when I saw this in patients. Though I've seen this play out in many thousands of patients. I've seen this in a real life setting, both in my office and the social media experience. In other words, online, people report to me every day on the blog, the Wheat Belly blog, the Wheat Belly Facebook page, and other social media. Every day, I'll have dozens of stories. I lost 40 pounds in the last two months. I'm off my insulin. I'm off one diabetes drug. I have one left to go. This is happening every day. But the data, the formal data, formal clinical data, already exist. The argument offered by the nutrition community is this. They say that there are lots of data proving that healthy whole grains are good for you. And what I've told them is, no, there's not. There's plenty of data showing that whole grains are superior to consumption of white and rich flour. So when we have the data like the Nurses' Health Study or the Physicians' Health Study, these are large studies that compared the effects of consuming whole grains versus consumption of white flour, there is an apparent health benefit. There's no question about that. If you replace white flour with whole grains, you get less diabetes, less weight gain, and less heart disease, less cancer. The question not answered in those studies is if there's something bad, white flour, replaced with something less bad, whole grains, and there's an apparent health benefit, what's the effect of complete removal? And there we turn to other studies where there has been complete removal of wheat, and that's where you see incredible turnarounds in health. What has not been done is a large, long-term trial, let's say 10,000 people over 5 years. We do need to have that kind of data.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I'm not willing to wait to have my acid reflux, diabetes, hypertension,
right,
psychiatric illness get better for that long-term study.
Give up the wheat today. Dr. Davis, we're out of time. I could talk about this for a long time, but thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food and for this very interesting information on wheat.
My pleasure.
Okay, have a good day. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and have a delicious week.